Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
You would have every vehicle, every apparatus in the fleet staffed for that night, and now you are lucky if you can staff 1 or 2 vehicles.
Alaska has seen a steep decline in the number of volunteer firefighters. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, fisheries managers discuss protections for tanner crab off Kodiak Island.
The bright spot in our future is that crab fishery. I think it's going to be really critical in these next few years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
A federal judge has dismissed the state of Alaska's lawsuit against the federal government over contamination on Alaska Native Corporation lands. Assuming the judgment stands, it prevents one avenue for forcing a solution to a decades-long saga. The problem centers on dump sites, fuel depots, and other polluted sites on land the federal government transferred to Alaska Native Corporations as part of the 1971 Land Claims Settlement Act. Jason Bruni is commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, the state agency that brought the lawsuit.
There were well over 1,000 contaminated sites that were conveyed as part of the 44 million acre, quote, settlement for dealing with indigenous land claims, and they were given damaged goods.
The lawsuit claimed the U.S. Interior Department did not fulfill a congressional mandate to address the contamination. U.S. District Court Judge H. Russell Holland said Congress required the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management to create a remediation plan, not to carry it out. The judge also said the state has no standing to sue. A state press release accuses the government of evading responsibility. It quotes Governor Mike Dunleavy calling the judge's decision a maddening excuse. Of the known contaminated sites on Native Corporation land, only about half have been cleaned up. It would take an estimated $50 billion to remediate all of them. Congress last year appropriated $27 million to do the job, spearheaded by the Environmental Protection Agency. Tammy Fordham directs the EPA's operations in Alaska. This year, Fordham says 5 Native organizations applied for the money to address 7 contaminated sites.
Our whole commitment on this is to learn and adapt, and I think there'll be, I'm sure, others coming in for projects and looking to really help accelerate cleanup of contaminated lands in Alaska.
Fordham says likely remediation projects so far are Unalaska's Strawberry Hill dump site, a drum disposal location near Tyonek, and asbestos contamination in former Navy buildings in Utqiagvik. Alaska Attorney General Treg Taylor says the state is studying the judge's order for possible appeal. Meanwhile, the State Department of Environmental Conservation will test the drinking water in nearly 200 Alaska Native villages to identify levels of PFAS contamination. That's beginning this fall. The EPA has linked PFAS to cancer and other health issues. For Alaska communities, the forever chemicals have been found after the use of fire-retarding foam at airports. Cindy Christian manages the state's drinking water program, and she says PFAS chemicals are still used in fighting fuel-based fires at military facilities or airports, which Alaska has a lot of.
In other states, every little town doesn't have an airport, but in Alaska, most of our little communities, especially in the rural areas, do have airports. And so a lot of the PFAS contamination that we found in the state is associated with airport activities.
The Alaska legislature passed a bill that requires a switch to alternative firefighting foam options by next year. But Christian says the damage has already been done in at least 5 communities. She says the state is currently helping replace or supplement contaminated water in Cold Bay, Gustavus, Yakutat, Dillingham, and King Salmon.
some of the those systems are getting bottled water. Some of them have already been provided with an alternative source of water. Maybe it's hooked up to another public water system, or they've gotten a new well. So we're in various stages in quite a few communities in addressing PFAS.
Those communities were found to have unsafe levels of PFAS through a special contaminated sites program, but Alaska does not currently regulate the forever chemicals in drinking water. Christian says there are some in-home water filters that can remove them, but if your community has not yet heard from the state, she doesn't expect they'll find PFAS in your drinking water. The EPA has proposed a rule they hope to finalize this year that would regulate 6 different PFAS chemicals, which Christian's department would then begin regulating. The newly announced monitoring plan is funded by a tribal-focused grant, so it only targets Alaska Native villages. But Christian says they plan to sample the rest of the state water systems later this year. The number of volunteer firefighters in Alaska has dropped by nearly half since 2014, according to state fire marshal data. And it could be putting communities at risk. KFSK's Thomas Copeland has the story.
You can find the Petersburg Volunteer Fire Department about a mile out of town. Aaron Hankins is the director of fire, EMS, and search and rescue. He is just one of 3 employees here. The rest, all volunteers. Right now, Hankins is doing a routine vehicle inspection after a fire which engulfed Petersburg's Catholic Church earlier this month.
This is engine 6, and if you want to take a look on the inside, we'll go ahead and get in.
All right, and we get.
Okay.
How many people can fit in this engine?
Engineer, officer, fireman, fireman, fireman.
5 seats.
5 seats.
When this engine left to go to the church fire, how many people were in here?
This engine rolled by itself.
So one person, just the driver?
Just the driver.
And why was that?
At the time, we needed more equipment on scene and not enough volunteers at hand.
And when there aren't enough volunteers available, that can hold back the rest from doing their jobs.
We shift from an offensive, go in, fight the fire where it's at, to a more defensive posture. We call it surround and drown, and are trying to fight the fire that may be burning inside from the outside of the building.
Is that a less effective strategy?
Yes.
This situation will sound very familiar to Alaska fire chiefs. The number of volunteer firefighters across the state has plummeted by 45% since 2014. That's more than double the decline seen nationwide. Justin Boddy is the president of the Alaska State Firefighters Association. He says the huge drop in volunteers is particularly stark when he thinks back to volunteer training sessions a decade ago.
You would have a packed house, you would have every vehicle, every apparatus in the fleet staffed for that night, and now you are lucky if you can staff 1 or 2 vehicles.
And while volunteers are clearing out, the phone lines are getting busier. Calls to U.S. fire departments have more than tripled since the 80s.
Everybody calls 911 now if they have a problem. So now we're not just going to medical emergencies and vehicles or structures on fire. We now go to all rescue scenarios, hazardous materials, service calls, down power line, utility calls, and much, much more.
Plus, Boddy says that Alaska faces another pretty unique problem. Among first responders, there's this thing called mutual aid. Basically, if there's a big fire in a town, engines from the next town over can race down the road to help out. But Alaska has a lot of hard-to-reach communities, like Petersburg on an island or Nome off the highway system.
Lower 48 can keep requesting resources from miles and miles and miles away, where we do not have that luxury here in Alaska.
All of this isn't just a problem for fire departments. Volunteering in general has declined in America over the last 15 years. So says Dr. Nathan Dietz, research director of the Do Good Institute at the University of Maryland. He says the pandemic made everything worse. Data from AmeriCorps shows that volunteering in this country has fallen by 7% since 2019. That drop even took Dietz by surprise.
That's 4 or 5 percentage points more than any drop that I've ever seen in the past.
He says the pandemic impacted volunteering in 2 ways. First, it broke our habits.
People were first unable to do what they always had done. And when they were able to do it, then they kind of did a top to bottom rethink of all the things that they had been committed to doing.
And second, people got used to being online.
Now that they can go back to the organization, I would think many probably haven't.
But you can't battle a burning building in front of your laptop. So back at the Petersburg Fire Department, Aaron Hankin says he needs to find new ways of attracting volunteers. There is at least one thing that seems to work: seeing firefighters in action.
Since the fire last week, we've had about five people sign up.
And why do you think they've signed up?
When we do have those instances of major fire and the town, you know, realizes that, oh, there's only a couple guys walking outside.
But if Alaska fire departments want to keep functioning, they'll need a more sustainable recruitment strategy than simply waiting for the next big blaze.
And from the cab of Petersburg Volunteer Fire Department Engine 6, I'm Thomas Copeland.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a popular Thai restaurant in Anchorage transforms into a makeshift arcade.
It's almost like a sporting event. You know, it's just like the energy, the camaraderie, the, you know, the competitiveness. It's just very fun.
All of that coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows.
For the first time on record, there will be no fall hunt for Nelchina caribou. Division of Wildlife Conservation Regional Management Coordinator Todd Rinaldi says the herd, popularly hunted off the Glen, Richardson, and Denali highways, has long been considered a management success.
We've been able to manage that herd and provide substantial harvest for Alaskan for a number of years, going over 50 years.
Rinaldi says managers increased the harvest for a period during the past decade when the herd exceeded a population objective, and that was followed by extreme winters beginning in 2020.
Deep snow, early persistent snow, high precipitation, and both years were followed by late springs coinciding with a late migration and a late calving period. And so overwinter mortality of adults and calves has been really high the last few years, and that's ended up in a reduction in the overall population numbers.
Rinaldi says a fall 2022 census showed that the Nelchina herd had dropped from its objective size of between 35 and 40,000 animals to 17,400. A high bull-to-cow ratio enabled last fall's hunt to go, but he says that's no longer the case.
The ratios are down, the population's down, so there is really no harvestable surplus in the population to offer.
The first ever closure means no Tier 1 or community subsistence hunts for Nelchina caribou.
We have also advised federal hunt administrators to cancel the Nelchina hunts in Unit 13, and we'll also be making a similar recommendation to Unit 12 federal hunt administrators.
Rinaldi says an updated population estimate for the Nelchina herd is expected out soon, based on the results of a traditional herd count and a photo census completed over the last month. The last 2 years have been big for Kodiak Tanner crab fishermen. Processors offered record prices back in 2022, and this year's harvest levels were the highest they've been in nearly 40 years, making it the largest crab fishery in the state. But as KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, all that attention has also renewed discussions about how to best manage and protect the fishery going forward.
Back in January, boats sat on anchor waiting to offload their huge crab harvests at Kodiak processors, sometimes for a week or more.
There was just a lot of crab out there.
Teresa Peterson is the fisheries policy director for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Her family has been fishing commercially in and around Kodiak for decades, including for Tanner. Kodiak's Tanner crab population tends to fluctuate, but when numbers are good, the season opens in mid-January. More than 130 vessels participated in this year's fishery. Peterson says it's welcome work for skippers and crew.
The Tanner crab fishery provides a really important source of revenue for small boat fishermen in the dead of winter when there's really little to no other fishing income opportunities.
That revenue was worth nearly $20 million to the local fleet this year. The available harvest was 5.8 million pounds. Biologists say the quota was likely the peak of a large crab cohort that was first observed back in 2018. the next few years will likely be good too. Peterson says the fleet is already banking on it, particularly as catch limits and prices have been cut in other areas.
With the price of salmon that we're looking at right now, the bright spot in our future is that crab fishery. I think it's going to be really critical in these next few years.
The bulk of Kodiak's Tanner crab is found on the east side of the island, and an area known locally as the Sandbox is a Tanner hotspot. It also overlaps with a federal groundfish fishery. And that's where things get complicated. Conversations about conservation in the Sandbox have been going on for a while.
I've been trying to get Tanner crab protections for 19 years.
Alexis Kwachka is the skipper of the fishing vessel No Point. He's also a member of the Kodiak Crab Alliance Cooperative, which represents Tanner permit holders. He says bycatch is a main concern.
As Tanner crab fishermen, we're bearing all the burden of conservation. So we want accountability on the interaction with other gear groups.
Kodiak-based bottom trawlers have fished for flatfish like rock sole and arrowtooth flounder in years past in and around the Sandbox. The trawl fishery didn't open the last 2 years, but this spring they ran just over a dozen trips to test the market. That's also when biologists say crabs are in their vulnerable molt stage, and crabbers want more monitoring to make sure Tanner crabs aren't scooped up as bycatch. Right now, trawlers and fixed-gear vessels in the water off Kodiak are monitored for bycatch either by observers on board or electronically with cameras, which are on just a fraction of the time. Julie Bonney is the executive director of the Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, which represents Kodiak-based trawlers. She says it's costly and takes time to implement monitoring programs, and right now, there's not enough data to expand monitoring across the fleet.
Let's bring the information back, decide whether we have a problem, and if we do, how we're going to fix it.
Kwachka and a group of other fishermen asked the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to make changes. At the council's meeting in June, they proposed a cameras-on-all-the-time policy known as 100% electronic monitoring for all vessels in the hotspot area.
With electronic monitoring, it kind of takes all that guesswork out of it. If the cameras are on all the time, whether you're a trawler or a longliner or a pot fisherman, it makes it so we can just do a better job.
It's a familiar ask. More than a decade ago, the council considered expanding monitoring at the Sandbox, but it ultimately didn't go anywhere. This time around, the council didn't approve more observers or monitoring either, but they did vote to gather and compare data from all gear groups in the Sandbox. Bonnie, with the trawlers, says it's a good starting point to balance everyone's interests.
It's a big deal to have all fisheries be successful. And so from a small boat perspective, the Tanner crab fishery was really significant for those guys this year, and thankful for that. But also as a trawl person, we want to have healthy flatfish fisheries and bottom fishing around the island as well.
Kwachka says he and other crabbers were frustrated that the council didn't go further. But he's cautiously optimistic that the door is open to possible future action. Peterson, with the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, says the council process is slow by design, and she's also encouraged by the June meeting. She says the fact that so many gear groups fish out of Kodiak should be a strength for future management, not a weakness.
Kodiak's a fishery-dependent community, reliant on all kinds of species, you know, salmon, halibut, sablefish, cod, herring, groundfish, crab, and that working together, we can help to identify fishing patterns where you're able to prosecute your fisheries without impacting another fishery.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is set to pick up the discussion at its December meeting, just about a month before Kodiak crabbers will set their gear for the next season. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Every other Monday night, a long-standing Thai restaurant in Anchorage transforms into a makeshift arcade. People flock to Thai Kitchen to compete in video game tournaments. As Alaska Public Media's Dev Hardiker reports, it's a chance for them to make a new friend or a new rival.
Let's go!
A crowd forms in the closed Thai restaurant where people are locked in tense virtual one-on-one fights. Chairs are stacked up against the back wall. Computer monitors occupy the restaurant's tables. Contestants hammer on the buttons of their arcade controllers. It's Monday Night Combat, a fighting video game tournament that happens every other week in Anchorage's Thai Kitchen. Today, they're playing Street Fighter. The event is organized by Banky Kichponich, a lifelong Anchorage resident whose family has run the restaurant for 37 years. He's been involved in competitive fighting games since he was a kid.
I was 13. Yeah, I was 13. So I'm 30 now. I've been doing it for 17 years.
The competitions are a chance for Kichponich and his friends, and anyone who might walk in the door, to sharpen their skills and meet other like-minded people. Competitors mill around between matches, talking strategy and poking fun at each other. It's one of few remaining spaces in the city where people can play video games face-to-face. That used to be the only way to do it, but Kichponich says arcades started disappearing when online gaming took off in the early 2000s. Now, he says, most people just play over the internet.
People just prefer to sit in their home, you know, comfortably. They don't have to go anywhere. Just as easy to play with friends. I totally see the appeal, you know?
But Kichponich says playing in person has an entirely different appeal.
There's definitely a different vibe to offline events. People get really hype, just watch it, you know? We're like, we'll egg each other on, talk some crap to each other.
He first started organizing monthly competitions in the neighboring frozen yogurt store in 2017, but the pandemic brought those to a halt.
Since COVID just pretty much like shut down all the offline events, we didn't have anything for a really long time, right? And people were just missing the offline competition.
The pandemic also impacted his family's restaurant. Thai Kitchen has exclusively done takeout orders since May 2020 and started closing on Mondays. Kichponich saw this as the perfect opportunity to relaunch the gaming tournaments.
When I found out that, hey, we're going to be closing once a week finally, I was like, is it cool if I throw some video game tournaments here? Because there's nowhere else in town I can really do that. They're like, yeah, of course, you know, just like clean up after yourself. That's basically it, you know.
He started Monday Night Combat in June 2021. Matches are live streamed on Twitch with two people doing commentary for the audience.
Straight to the left three. He wants the damage. He wants that early lead.
That's Rafael Borromeo, a longtime commentator and competitor. He's been part of the scene for 14 years. He says the atmosphere of offline tournaments can't be beat.
You ever watch a fighting game on a big screen, big crowd, everyone's yelling? It's almost like a sporting event. It's kind of like watching a UFC fight, but not exactly the same, obviously. But, you know, it's just like the energy, the camaraderie, the competitiveness. It always brings me back.
Over the years, Anchorage's competitive fighting game scene has essentially become one tight-knit group of friends, with a couple new faces every tournament. Kichponich says all kinds of people show up. Some are completely new to fighting games, and some have been playing them competitively for their entire lives.
Instead of just like teams that are invited to play, it's basically an open bracket. So, you know, Joe Schmo from down the street can come over, play against Michael Jordan.
It costs $2 to come play and another $5 to enter a tournament bracket. The winners get a cut of the earnings. At the most recent event, 20 people entered, and first place went home with $50. Kichponich says it's usually a pretty small cash prize. People really just compete because they love to compete.
It's more of a passion thing, you know, and you get a free lunch if you win, basically, so yeah.
At the end of the night, the tables are cleared of monitors. On Tuesday, Thai Kitchen opens for lunch, as if nothing ever happened. In Anchorage, I'm Dev Hardiker.
A giant potato has been traveling around the country for 11 years and is coming to Alaska for the first time this weekend, heading to Skagway. The outsized tater may be a promotional scheme by the Idaho Potato Commission, but as KHNS's Alan DePremenil reports, Skagway is embracing the weirdness and rolling out the red carpet.
There is a classic Idaho postcard.
Locals know that there's a postcard that has it's a tractor trailer.
Sue Kennedy has spent her career with the Idaho Potato Commission's marketing department.
and on the back is a giant potato, and it's all made up. And it's like, they grow them big in Idaho.
In 2012, for its 75th anniversary, the Idaho Potato Commission decided to bring the postcard to life. The group built a fiberglass potato the size of a humpback whale, loaded it on a bright red semi-truck, and sent it on a year-long tour to promote the local crop.
And people loved it. It was only supposed to be on the road for 1 year. So now we're 11 years, and we've been to every city so many times. So we thought, let's go someplace new.
That place is Skagway.
They should be here, hopefully, barring no more trouble with the truck. They'll be here on Friday.
Jamie Bricker is the tourism director in Skagway. She says when the Idaho Potato Commission called her earlier this year to inquire about visiting, she saw an opportunity to add color and weirdness to a local yearly event.
We are doing a parade through town, and then the potato truck will go out to Dedman Stage for Skagway Arts Council's Blues, Brews, and Barbecues.
The music festival has taken on a spud theme. Local bands are getting a makeover.
The Metater Jam Dahlia Band will be making a showing, and Dictator and the Tots will be there.
The mayor is expected to read a proclamation at the next borough assembly meeting, declaring July 22nd, 2023, as Idaho Potato Day in Skagway. Two locals with Idaho roots will be crowned Queen and King of Potatoes for the day, and local restaurants will serve a variety of potato dishes. Under the whimsical outreach, Idaho potatoes are big business. Kennedy says about 13 billion pounds of the vegetable are grown every year in the state. That is one of every three potatoes grown in the U.S. Kennedy says another giant potato was built before.
Oh, have you heard about the Potato Hotel? Because we had another version of this, but it just couldn't travel anymore because it was made of steel and some concrete. So now we planted it in Idaho, and it's an Airbnb.
Kennedy says her potato travels about 25,000 miles a year. When asked how much the operation costs, she says she cannot disclose the numbers, but her answer opens a small window into the world of traveling food effigies.
But I'll tell you what, our budget is small potatoes compared to some of the other traveling mobiles that are out there. Like the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile. I think they've been up to Alaska. And, oh, the Planet Peanermobile, the Peanutters. I think they've got bigger budgets.
Kennedy says the giant potato will travel to Hawaii soon. For KHNS, I'm Alan DePremenil.
Well, you know it's the end of Alaska News Nightly when the giant potato story rolls. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Michael Finelli and Dev Hardiker in Anchorage, Thomas Copeland in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Alan DePremenil in Haines, although covering giant potato news in Skagway. If you want to send us a news tip, potato-related or otherwise, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.